This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street all across North Dakota. And today we're going to talk with Jack Russell Weinstein about this Sunday's Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life show on the Prairie Public Radio Network. Because, Jack, you've got one very provocative discussion about a very important topic. The question you're talking about this week is free speech worth it?
Hi, Doug, and thanks. And yes, it's unfortunate to have something that isn't timely at all, that no one can identify with, that people just can't figure out why we're talking about it at all. So it's a deficit, but I'm going to work through it.
Why did you want to talk about it with Thane Rosenbaum?
Thane had been on the show before. He's a very good, fun, likable, and articulate guest. But he also comes from a position that is neither clearly left nor right, neither liberal nor conservative. He picks and chooses what he thinks makes the most sense from both positions. And that makes for a very compelling and very interesting argument, because we're not going to get listeners who just think, oh, I know this, or oh, I hate this. We're going to get lots of different listeners who think, oh, that's an interesting piece of the puzzle. Let me put this all together.
He's a distinguished university professor at Touro College in New York City. He's a novelist and essayist and the author of a new book titled provocatively, Saving Free Speech from Itself. Let's get into that. Rosenbaum says Western democracies besides ourselves would not put up with our freewheeling application of the First Amendment.
We spent a fair amount of time talking about this. If you look at the European countries in particular, if you look at Israel, you will see that there are a lot of things that we allow that they just won't. The most obvious example is neo-Nazis marching in the street. Europe has a different history than we do of this sort of thing, but nevertheless, advocating Nazi positions is illegal, and protesting with signs and shouting Nazi positions is also illegal. Shouting other kind of bigoted things is also illegal. And so the United States philosophically is what he would call a free speech absolutist. We take the position that everything is permissible, whereas none of the other democracies in the world do. None of the other democracies are as permissive to everything. I believe he said, you know, anything that comes out of the mouth of a lunatic, right? Anyone gets to say anything they want in the United States, and the government really can't punish them for it. In other countries, that's not the case.
Well, as those of us in our business, the news business, the public discussion business know, there are proscriptions on the First Amendment right. I mean, they're limited by libel or slander or defamation, so-called fighting words as well. But what we're talking about specifically here is political speech or the moral elements of free speech.
Well, interestingly enough, one of the conversations that we had throughout the episode is that the fighting words doctrine almost never gets implemented. It is good law. It was articulated in a Supreme Court case, Chaplinsky versus the United States, not quite a century ago, but it's never cited. And so using racial slurs, accusing someone of something horrific, personally insulting them, these are all considered unconstitutional under the fighting words doctrine, but it's never implemented. And so it's as if the fighting word doctrine doesn't exist. So yes, libel, slander, these are things that are often prosecuted or there are complaints again, but look at what happened in Virginia. Look at some of the things that are said during the Black Lives Matter marches. Look at the kind of acts and expression that people who are protesting against masks use. And these would all fit as fighting words because they are intended to incite insult or violence, but the courts don't rule against them.
Well, we've got political speech that I think an objective listener would say is intended to threaten, intended to intimidate, intended in some cases even to traumatize people, or to deliver untruths for political purposes, or to humiliate people. We've certainly heard a few examples of that in the last few years. And this creates this other dilemma confronting social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter, because it's like a free-for-all out there.
It is. So compare, for example, public radio and Facebook. Public radio tries very hard to express a range of opinions and sometimes is fairly provocative, But there is this standard of truth. There is this reputation. There is this professionalism that permeates all of public radio, that anyone who is on public radio, you certainly feel this way, I certainly feel this way, feels tremendous pressure to contribute to that. But Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, these platforms are protected by law against liability from what people say. And so Facebook in particular has no pressure to stop people from saying things that are untrue or stop saying things that are violent. When you aren't limited by not just legal liability, but social and moral liability, when your reputation is not at stake, then you can put this off and say, hey, look, we're not saying this. We're just letting people have free speech. This is the responsibility of the poster. But the posters, sometimes they can't be identified, and sometimes they're just horrible people who don't know anything.
Well, let's talk about civility. Thane Rosenbaum says that the word dignity does not appear in our Constitution, but it is often used in the governing documents of other nations. And he thinks that should be a determinant in what is legitimate free speech.
This idea of dignity is very powerful. He quotes Lyndon Johnson, I believe, as saying in response to the Civil Rights Act of 1964, as saying a man has a right not to be humiliated in front of his children.
Yeah.
Right? This is a really powerful, for me, expression. Imagine you're walking down the street with your child and someone shout something horrible. If you're black, someone uses the N-word. If you're Jewish, someone insults you for that. If you're gay or lesbian, someone accuses you of being a crime against God, right? And your child hears this. As Thane points out, you can't explain to your kid that this is an ideology that can be put aside. Your kid isn't going to sleep for 2 weeks. And if you spend your whole life hearing that, if every time you walk out of your house, you are humiliated, your dignity disappears, your psychological health suffers, and your physical health suffers. And so this idea of dignity, this idea of respecting someone's personhood and humanity and speech and expression, having to respect that, America does not have that at all. And many of the European countries have that because in part of their own history and in part because their sense of what a community is very different than what the American sense is.
And speech, of course, has a broad definition here. It's not purely verbal or published or something like that. It's often symbolic. We've recently, of course, heard about the Confederate battle flag. It's been in the news again. And we have Second Amendment advocates protesting with guns. I'm thinking of the incident in the Michigan Capitol. Or counter-protesting, carrying weapons around other protesters, or burning crosses.
That's right. So one of the things that the Supreme Court has done in the last 100 or so years is extended the notion of free speech to clothing you can wear, signs you can have in your windows, music you can play. Artistic expression is protected under free speech, and I think that's absolutely wonderful. But at the same time, it means that as social norms change, there is more opportunity to violate people's dignity and violate people's safety. Let me give an example that didn't actually come up in the discussion. In the 1960s, there was a case against the left-wing hippies because they would wear American flags as clothing. They would make vests out of American flags. They would have it on the back of their shirts and things like that. And conservatives really objected to it, and they sued them because someone was arrested for it, for desecrating the flag. Well, the Supreme Court ruled that this was okay. Fast forward to the last 10, 20 years, and wearing the American flag has become a sign of conservative political points of view. Now it's the conservatives, it's the right wing who wears the American flag as bathing suits, who wears the American flags as shirts, right? How do you decide what the message is of a piece of clothing and who it's going to offend and who isn't? And this is why for Thane, the distinction is not about offense, but about harm. This is one of his most important distinctions in the book. The difference between wearing an American flag is it might offend someone, but it doesn't harm someone. Calling someone the N-word or using it on your shirt for someone to read it, that causes real and identifiable psychological damage. All of the neurology bears this out. And over a lifetime, it causes heart disease and diabetes and all sorts of stress-related illnesses. So for Thane, the big shift is, can you identify real harm, not just physical harm, psychological harm? If you can, it shouldn't be permitted. But if it just offends you, that's not a big deal.
Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of Why? Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life. You can hear it this Sunday at 5 Central on Prairie Public's radio network. Jack, you just referenced Thane Rosenbaum in his book, Saving Free Speech from Itself. He cites that familiar nursery rhyme, sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me. And he says that was never true. And as you just suggested, he cites scientific proofs that hate speech causes physical harm.
Well, so think about something humiliating that happened in your life, right? We all have examples. Some are worse than others. And think about what your body does when you think about it. You still get angry. You still get flushed. Your temperature still rises. You still, in your imagination, feel the impact of that humiliation. Now, compare that to a physical accident you had. I've broken my arm. I've broken my finger. I've broken my nose. I'm not the most graceful person in the world. And when I think about those things, doesn't bother me. Physical pain is not remembered, but psychological pain is carried with you for your entire life. And what the neuroscience has shown is that that's not, I don't know how to put it, but that's not just our imagination. You can see in the brain activity permanent neurological consequences of humiliation, especially long-term systemic humiliation. And so sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never hurt me. In fact, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words hurt me more, longer, and more profoundly than sticks and stones ever can.
He also spoke about an incident I recall somewhat vividly. I didn't realize it was so long ago. 1978, neo-Nazis marched in Skokie, Illinois, through a Jewish neighborhood where about 7,000 Holocaust survivors lived. And that was defended by the ACLU.
That's right. So that's a very, very famous case. If you've ever seen the movie The Blues Brothers, they make fun of it because the Blues Brothers get to drive right through a protest of Illinois Nazis. There was this neighborhood where a lot of Holocaust survivors had been relocated and had been living their lives, and because they made it to America and they were trying to get through the consequences. And the Illinois Nazi Party wanted to assert their superiority. So they got a legal permit to march through the neighborhood carrying swastikas, shouting horrible things, with the sole purpose of letting the Holocaust survivors know that they were not safe. Now, famously, the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, defended those Nazis. Jewish lawyers defended them for free against the wishes of the Jews in the neighborhood. And this has become the paradigm case for the ACLU. But in recent years, as the neo-Nazi movement has risen up again and has become more violent and used guns and other imagery of revolution, of coup d'etat, of mass violence, many of the lawyers in the ACLU have said enough is enough. Our job is not to defend racists. Our job is to defend freedom and liberty and truth. And so there is now a discussion in the ACLU about who the ACLU should defend. And as Thane thinks, it's a compromise principle, but as a compromise position, they said, we're never going to defend people who use guns in their protests. So there is a line, but the fundamental philosophical question is, how much do you tolerate the intolerant? How much does free speech give the intolerant rights over the tolerant? Or can we say that there is a line that people can't cross, even in the realm of free speech?
You had a personal experience with a hate crime several years ago in Grand Forks, and share that with our listeners and sort of the follow-up to that story.
Sure. My wife was pregnant with our daughter, so it was almost exactly 15 years ago. I was out of town. She was out of town in different areas. And we get a phone call that someone had drawn a swastika in front of our house. We're the only Jews in the neighborhood. There was no way that it wasn't targeted. There was no way that the people didn't know what they were doing. And when we spoke to the police, they were wholly uninterested. They said, if I felt scared in Seattle, I should call the Seattle police. And I used some back channels because it's Grand Forks and it's a small community. And I got the police to keep an eye on our house while we were away. Now, my wife is pregnant. We're here, I think, 4 years at this point. And we stopped feeling safe in our home, and we stopped feeling welcome in our community, because this showed that the entire community knew that we were, quote unquote, different and that we were being targeted. But the police refused to call it a hate crime, and they refused to take it seriously, of which I will say I'm still very angry related to the imagination thing that we talked about. Fast forward. You may recall about a few months ago, there was an incident where a bunch of people were on a roof near the University of North Dakota shouting out white power slogans and trying to create racial unrest. They were arrested and charged with a hate crime. And we found out through gossip and other things that a few weeks ago in the city council meeting, some people objected to the fact that it was called a hate crime. And the police said, well, you have to understand that about 15 years ago, this family, this Jewish family, was targeted with a swastika, and we didn't think it was a hate crime. And the FBI came along and said, of course it's a hate crime. It's a swastika, and this is a hate crime too, and we have to do what the FBI said. And so in addition to all of the other things, the personal fear, the personal attack, wanting to protect my pregnant wife and my unborn child, right? Independent of all of that is this idea that not only did the police not take it seriously, but when they were told they didn't take it seriously, they never told us. And we only found out 15 years later that not only were we right and they were wrong, but that someone cared enough to call them out on it. Now, this is important philosophically, because the question of what a hate crime is and the question of what hate speech is fundamental to this distinction that Thain is bringing out, because offense does not make something hate speech, but harm makes something hate speech. And so this distinction between harm and offense is essential to protecting people who are vulnerable. And yes, I am a tenured professor at the University of North Dakota, but if you and your young wife and your unborn child are surrounded by people who you perceive as possibly hating or threatening you, that has a fundamental effect on your life, and it absolutely has.
Do we still have neo-Nazis and Klansmen largely because their hate speech has been protected?
I don't know the answer to that. That's a really good question. We certainly have the public performance of neo-Nazis because their hate speech is protected. It has become much more acceptable, and these sorts of insults and imagery and internet videos and things permeate the web because they're protected. Now, there is a question as to whether or not banning this sort of thing, letting it fester behind the scenes, is better or worse, right? So there are some people who say airing out the grievances, you know, the only response to a good idea is a bad idea. I'm sorry, the only response to a bad idea is a good idea. And that's in certain sense, that's an empirical question, that's a scientific question, we can investigate it. But in another sense, the more we allow these things to be public, the more we are saying it's okay. And that's where the Confederate battle flag really comes in. In the South, particularly, although not exclusively, there is this notion that showing the Confederate flag is acceptable. And because it's acceptable, there's also a sense that other forms of overt racism, other forms of insult, other forms of expression are also publicly accessible. In places like New York City or Los Angeles or San Francisco, where displaying the Confederate flag is absolutely not acceptable and you would get tremendous social response by displaying it, those forms of outward racism and outward prejudice are also unacceptable. So I think that it's not simply that the free speech protects the idea, but it's that the free speech protects all of the things that surround the idea, including the sentiment that most of us, I think, hope would disappear.
Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. You can hear it this Sunday at 5 Central on Prairie Public's radio network. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you, Doug. It's a pleasure as always.
Coming up on Main Street, a related commentary from Mark Trahant.
Disney World reopens this weekend, even as coronavirus cases in Florida remain high. What measures is the park taking to keep risk low for visitors and employees?
You can have society function in a way that keeps people safe. Disney, I have no doubt it's going to be a safe environment.
Plus, a closer look at Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts and his role in the court's recent decisions. That's on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. America's minority populations are getting attention. Just today, the Supreme Court ruled that a large part of eastern Oklahoma is Native American land for the purpose of law enforcement. The ruling said federal, not state law, should apply to crimes committed in that part of the state. And earlier this week, a federal judge ordered the shutdown of the Dakota Access Pipeline next month for a comprehensive review of its effect on the environment, a decision supported by the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. Indian Country Today editor Mark Trahant says another long-simmering issue is also under review, nicknames for sports teams.
There was a strategy in place from Suzanne Harjo and many others involved in the fight over the Washington NFL franchise, and that was to leverage the world of investment. Last week, 88 investors representing $620 billion in assets sent letters to Nike, FedEx, and Pepsi urging those companies to terminate their business and public relationships with the Washington team. Everything changed because of the death of George Floyd and Black Lives Matter. At that moment, it became impossible for companies to hide behind their own words. The campaign with FedEx has been going on for more than a decade now, said Carla Fredericks. She's the director of the American Indian Law Clinic at the University of Colorado Law School. In 2014, Susan White was director of the United Trust. She had been calling for FedEx shareholders to take action. "We are the only race of people dehumanized by an NFL team," she told the shareholders. For 6 years, the Oneida and co-filers have been talking with FedEx about the controversy surrounding the name of the Washington, D.C. NFL franchise and FedEx's association through its naming rights on the team stadium. The challenge is to hold companies accountable for their own words. If you're going to make statements about racial justice, equity, then you mustn't forget that those statements also must include the treatment of indigenous people and your relationship with the Washington football team, said Carla Fredericks. She described this moment as tipping the boulder off the cliff. It really was a case of being ready to engage in a way that was right at the time. And what's now for the Washington team? Fredericks said change has to be substantive, ideally consulting Native leadership before any decisions are made. Change has to include the logo and even the team colors, and answering, how will the team regulate the behavior of its fans who refuse to go along? The University of North Dakota's hockey team is an example of that, because fans often refuse to sport the school's new logo, Fighting Hawks, and continue to chant offensive refrains from the past. That's the type of thing that can be really insidious and harmful to Native people, Frederick said. There really has to be a complete pivot. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can follow Mark Trahant's commentary and Native news at IndianCountryToday.com. Coming up on Main Street, horticulturist Ron Smith and Main Street Eats with Sue Belkum. First, the news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. 99 new individuals have tested positive for COVID-19 in North Dakota. That brings the new statewide positive total to 4,070. The results were from a pool of 5,980 tests for a daily positive rate of 1.7%. Among the cases broke down by county are 29 for Cass County, Burley County with 23, Walsh County with 10, Williams County with 6, Morton County with 5, Cavalier County with 4. Montreal, Pembina, Richland, Grand Forks County, Stutsman, and Dickey counties all had one new case each. The American Petroleum Institute says the recent court decisions on the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Keystone XL Pipeline show the current federal permitting system is outdated and convoluted. A federal judge has ordered the Dakota Access Pipeline to be shut down and emptied. by the first week of August as the Army Corps of Engineers finishes an environmental impact statement. In audio provided by API, President and CEO Mike Summers says anti-fossil fuel activists are using the courts to further their agenda to block pipelines at all costs.
This sets our nation back, both by undermining America's energy progress and by denying local communities the benefits that modern pipelines provide. These include revenue, good-paying union jobs, and access to energy that's affordable, reliable, and cleaner.
Summers also says pipelines are the safest and the most environmentally responsible way to transport energy. Energy Transfer, the owner of the pipeline, is appealing the federal judge's ruling. At least one person died and several farms were flattened in western Minnesota after a tornado swept through the area yesterday evening. Tom Grover is the mayor of Ashby. He's also a member of the Ashby Fire Department. He says he received a call shortly after 5 p.m., and he clearly saw the tornado a few miles away.
It was a very large tornado, and it was on the ground. And it was coming right towards Ashby, but it about a mile and a half or 2 miles out, it switched and went a little bit to the northeast. And that's the four houses that were hit, the farm sites that were hit, they were all within a cluster of probably a couple miles.
Grover says the tornado was on and off the ground for several minutes. The person who died was working in a farm shop when the twister hit. The National Weather Service is assessing the damage. The service says it was likely an EF3 tornado with winds between 136 and 165 miles per hour. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg because it's time to talk with our horticulturist Ron Smith about some summer lawn and garden tips.
Ron, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. I enjoy it.
We have the hot, hot weather of July. I know it's good for me and my personal growth. Good for plants, too, some of them, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It's good stuff for plants. And they like all the heat that North Dakota can usually give them, as long as it isn't too much. But they also need some moisture to accompany that. And our soil is pretty dry. These last few weeks, we've had, piddly squat as far as rainfall goes. And people that have automatic irrigation systems, such as me, have been running them on their property. So it was kind of a good relief to have the Fargo-Moorhead area in the eastern part of the state get the rain that it got the other night. I had an inch and four-tenths in my backyard rain gauge, and that did a beautiful job of soaking the soil, bringing it up to field capacity, which is what you want to have it at, so there's no moisture stress in the root zones of the plants. Now, many plants can get into something that's called midday wilting, which upsets a lot of gardeners, and they think they aren't watering enough. But generally speaking, unless it's been a week to 10 days without any water whatsoever, that midday wilting is something that's going to go ahead and pass when the sun goes down and it gets cooler. Then the plant can go ahead and rehydrate itself with the moisture that's in that soil. But the moisture has to be there. But we've got some moisture in the soil for at least the next few days until we get another rain. So if you should see midday wilting on your plants like Joe Pye weed or tomato plants, or pepper plants, don't panic. You might stick your finger in the soil to see if it's moist enough, and if it isn't, go ahead and give it a shot of water. But many times, if you just go back and take a look at it at the end of the day when the sun's going down, will have rehydrated itself. The best time to water is in the early morning hours. I've said that probably 1,000 times in my life. So you want to, if you have an automatic system, you can go ahead and have come on at a particular time. In the 24-hour period, the best time is around 4 o'clock in the morning because you'll have maximum pressure. And generally, sweeping as a broad categorization, our winds are not as high at that time of the day as it would be any other time of the day. So you don't want to water when you're having a high wind characteristic day. You'll just blow water all over the place and not get good coverage.
What about fertilizer use this time of year?
If you're a gardener, you're going to fertilize your flowers and trees and shrubs and vegetables. And the earlier you do it, the better off it will be because they're in the reproductive cycle right now. They're going through this reproductive cycle where their flowers are blooming. They're getting fertilized, pollinated, fertilized. They're setting the seeds. And you don't want to keep pushing them to try to keep on producing new growth, new vegetative growth. So the thing to do is to give it a shot of fertilizer this weekend, and that's it. Put the Miracle-Gro, Rapid-Gro, or whatever grow you're using away for the rest of the season. And it should be okay. You should have enough nutrients there to get it through the 12 weeks or so that we have left of decent weather.
What about deadheading flowers? Should we be doing that here and there?
Yeah. Yes. Thank you, Ashley, for that question. It's a good one. We like to see flowers, and we don't like to see them when they are finished flowering. So the best thing to do is to try to get them as they start to go past their peak and deadhead them. You can deadhead them if you have good, sharp thumbnail. And so put that stem between your thumbnail and your index finger, or you can get in there with a sharp knife and just snip them off back to a whorl of leaves or a leaf axle, and you'll get a rebloom coming again probably in September. I know the salvias, the Maynite salvia that I have, does that. It blooms in June, not in May. It kind of confuses the time of the year, but it could be my microenvironment that it's in. And then it comes back again around mid-September, gives me a nice little purple bloom, which I totally enjoy. And it's the same thing with Gallardia, and the same thing, if you can get to it, the perennial geranium. So most perennials will go ahead and respond well to that. Some annuals need to be deadheaded in order to keep them blooming. The most conspicuous ones I can think of are snapdragons. So if you have snapdragons that are a nice little annual, as their flowers start to fade, get in there and snip them back, and you'll get a re-flushing of new flowers coming up this spring. Delphiniums, the very commonly used perennial in the North Dakota region, are looking their best right now. In another week, they're going to be starting to go downhill. Don't let them set their seeds. Cut that stem off that's got the flowers on it, and you'll get another nice little, a little bit more bashful bloom than you did with the initial bloom. And so that'll keep the color going through the rest of the growing season.
Any advice for mowing in the height of summer?
Ah, yes. A favorite subject of mine. And other than politics and religion, mowing height is one of the best ways to start an argument, is to see your neighbor almost scalp mowing their lawn in the summertime, because they see that being done at the golf course. And, of course, the golf course has literally unlimited use of water. So what we homeowners need to do is to set our mowing height at 3 inches. And if you don't know what that is, mess around with the adjustments on your wheels and put a 3-inch ruler down there, and or a ruler down there with 3 inches marked on it, of course, and it should be at that height. And I've had people argue with me, well, it's going to look like it's never going to be mowed. I'll never mow it at that height. Yes, you will. But they like that close crop mowing, and what it does is it has a tendency, it uses more gas, okay? It's harder on the mower. It's harder on the grass plant, and you're putting the grass plant under more stress because it has a weaker root system because of the lack of sufficient vegetation there to go ahead and make more photosynthates to get into the crown and the root system of the plant. So mow high, 3 inches, that's good. Keep it at that.
I scalp mow the back part of my yard specifically because I'm trying to get rid of it.
Well, yeah, if you have a purpose in mind like you do, actually, I know you like wildflower planting.
That's
the way to do it, and that's the best way to kill your lawn. Unfortunately, without chemicals, that is, the things that come back in are usually weeds.
Yeah, I do have a lot of Russian thistle right now. And so the next step will be the cardboard and compost. I'll put that down in the fall. And
okay.
We'll do the last third of the yard transition. So, yeah.
Okay. Persistence pays off. It always does. And don't give up. It's going to be a battle between you, your will, and Mother Nature's will. But you can predominate your wishes by staying to the course, and don't let them get a chance, get a foothold on you. Because once they do, they take over, as you know.
One more quick question here. I saw a photograph on Facebook last week of a real pile of ruby red rhubarb. Is the season over for that?
Absolutely, yes. If you're going to be harvesting rhubarb, you want to get it done by or before the 4th of July. Now, we're past the 4th of July, and if you're one of these people who say, oh, I forgot to do it, yeah, you can do it this week yet, but don't go ahead and harvest the whole plant. Harvest about a third to half of the stems there to make your rhubarb pie or to put it in the freezer, something along those lines. But don't keep harvesting it through this month. The 4th of July is usually the cutoff date set arbitrarily so people don't carry it too far into the summer.
We check in with horticulturist Ron Smith regularly during the growing season. Ron, thanks for being with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you. Great talking with you both.
And you can always email a question to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org.
Sue Balcom and Main Street Eats, next.
Next time on The Pulse, movies make it possible to immerse yourself in a different experience. And bringing movies to life in that way involves a lot of science.
If they don't have to move their eyes when you change the screen...
The sound it's imitating is a very short-lived sound. It has to involve high frequencies.
The science of movie magic.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and Sue Balcom. It's time for Main Street Eats.
Sue, thanks for joining us.
Yes, it's wonderful to be here again, even though we're not quite here yet, are we?
We are talking. Well, you know, normally, Sue, we're talking on the phone now, but normally we talk studio to studio. We're not in person.
Oh, yeah, I guess you're right. But people still will say to me, well, aren't you going to do your radio thing today? I'm like, yeah, been there, done that.
Sue Balcom joins us once a week from her farm outside of Mandan, the Root Cellars Farm, to talk about food and gardening. And one of the greatest parts of summer is how easy it is to love living in harmony with the seasons.
Absolutely.
I love yeah.
Me too. And I love vegetables, you know, like, I've been eating cucumbers, and when I thin out my garden rose, I eat what I pull out. I never throw any of that stuff away. I've got kale and beets going and all kinds of really good things. We were off to a little bit of a rocky start with the spring. You know, May had a couple of really seriously cold freezes,
yeah,
or frost, I guess. The frost is not quite as bad as a freeze, but it's been like, I've just been like, where's my garden? Where's my garden? Well, finally, the winds have died down and the sun is shining. And it's like, oh, it's just so hard to go indoors when it's like this.
You know, I listened to public radio and I heard on a story on public radio just recently that gardening has taken off this year because people are home, a little bit stir crazy.
Worried about the food supply.
They got a backyard, and exactly that, the food supply and not going to the grocery store all the time and time on their hands and a backyard that might need some cultivating.
Well, and that's exactly what I was thinking, too. It isn't just me anymore. I've seen a huge increase in activity out there, whether it's a Facebook group that people are buying and selling and starting gardens. And, you know, it's always been clear in my mind that grass is a waste of resources, you know, time, energy, and water when you could be growing food or flowers, you know. And so I've slowly been digging up our yard, and it's been a good thing. But if you're a true gardener, there isn't ever a weed that you won't stop to pull out of a planter, whether it's yours or the front of a hotel or the front of a bank. You can always tell the true gardener when they're weeding somebody else's little plot. That's a sure sign that you're hooked. And so it's a good thing, I think, that people are interested in local, but it's so funny to me how far people have been removed from the way things work in nature. So we had kind of a little test farmers market in June. And what we wanted to do was to see whether people would come and buy things from us, whether they were wearing masks, whether we needed to be a little more careful about offering coffee and cookies and things. And we had this little tiny market, and it must have been just the right weekend because there were two of us and we had so much fun. But one of the ladies that came that day, she was like, well, where's the vegetables? And I'd gotten this question before from my Facebook advertising. People are like, well, what kind of vegetables do you have? And we're like, well, it's only the middle of June. We had a very cold spring. We have greens. We have garlic scapes and we have lettuces and beet tops and things like that. But there aren't any like real major vegetables yet because it isn't time in North Dakota. And she's like, well, the farmers markets in Rapid City started in May already. I'm like, they're considerably further south than we are. Therefore, they start earlier. And their seasons are a little different.
And their climate is very different.
Oh, totally. And it varies from this side of the state to your side of the state. We have a lot warmer weather on more days than you guys do and way more sunshine than they do in the Red River Valley. I am, however, totally jealous of your black dirt, which always looks like it's wet. Capers. I don't know how you guys got so lucky.
It's Lake Bottom. It's good old Lake Agassiz.
That's right.
We're in mid-July, so what kinds of fruits and vegetables can we look for at the farmer's market?
There's actually going to be cucumbers and radishes. There should be beetroot. There's all kinds of lettuces, microgreens, and of course, baked goods and things. And we should be coming on like Juneberry season pretty soon. One of the things that people need to understand is that sometimes it's not up to us, it's up to Mother Nature. And every time you say to yourself, okay, I'm going to grow a crap load of cucumbers and a bunch of dill, and I'm going to put together pickling kits for people. Then, of course, you get the blight and your tomatoes are growing like crazy over here and your cucumbers are looking at you like, yeah, you shouldn't have been banking on us because we aren't quite ready to produce for you. So there might actually be lots of peas and green beans coming up here, too, in the middle towards the end of July. But one of the other things I noticed, too, was, you know, it's not just vegetables that are seasonal. Like you can't just go to a farmer and buy a cow and have it butchered. You know, these things take time. It takes time. It takes a whole season to raise a beef steer. Then you have to be able to get it into a butcher plant or a locker, which there aren't that many left in the state of North Dakota. At one time, there were lockers and creameries and all of these small businesses in these small communities so that you could easily assess local food. But now we have to be really, people have to learn about seasonality about these things. Eggs, you can't buy eggs in the middle of winter because the chickens stop laying when the number of hours of sunshine goes down. You can't grow things here in the middle of winter. Although, if any of you have been out there looking at my website or Facebook, I do have a brand new super big high tunnel. And I'm so stinking excited to be able to try and grow things earlier and later in the year and making plans.
I hope you start growing avocados, Sue. Do you have plans for that?
Well, you know, I've grown lots of avocado trees, but I've never been able to get them to bloom.
I know.
And I don't know, do they need a mate? You know, like, I don't know, maybe you have to have male and female avocados in a grove in order for them to grow.
I was visiting a friend at the lake last week, and he was showing me his garden, which was cut out of the woods, basically. And he had put down this this black fabric, this plastic-sized fabric, and punched holes in it. And that was really helping things grow. I mean, it was amazing the number of plants that were coming out of that thing.
Well, part of that is that black plastic will actually warm your soil up.
Yes.
And that's very helpful for plants to grow. And that also keeps the weed pressure off, Although, yeah, for those of you who know me, I'm a little bit of a lazy gardener, and I feel like, oh, you know, the weeds have a right to grow too in some places. Although I'm really trying hard to do a weed rotation this year, where I start in one garden and move my way through all four of them and then start back here again, at least until my plants get big. But yeah, black plastic is a lot of farmers will use that. There's actually special equipment that will lay down a row of black plastic and build a bed at the same time. And then you can go through and you can either use a board that has holes cut in and you burn holes in that plastic and then you plant in those holes. I use a scissors, of course, and I cut an X in there, which isn't the most effective way to do that sometimes because you're always dealing with that excess flap there. But there's actually a drill bit. You can drill holes in as you go along and then plant in there. So, yeah, that's pretty handy. And I would imagine in a wooded area, if he has trees, that might keep the soil a little cooler than it would out in the prairie where I live. I used to use the landscape fabric to try and grow vegetables, and I don't anymore.
Okay.
There's something about it that adds to the compaction of the soil. You know, and I don't know if it's just that it doesn't allow as much air or water through it. Some of them are treated with BT so that they keep weeds down. But yeah, I used to think I was so clever there. And then one day I'm like, yeah, there's something not right here. And I did a little research and basically pulled it all up. But don't let that stop you from using that plastic mulch. You can get solar mulch, you can solar plastic, and you can get those mulches in color, like tomatoes, like red plastic. I'm not sure why, but it must reflect a certain kind of light from the sun up into the fruit. So they like that. And then it biodegrades. You can get a biodegradable mulch that works like that landscape fabric. And that is what I would recommend if you were wanting to do that in your garden.
It extends the season at any rate. Those high tunnels, that special mulch, and those vegetables.
Yep. If you don't want to invest in a $10,000 high tunnel, they're not cheap, but they are super cool. And you can build your own. You can get a conduit bender, and you can buy these 6 or 10 foot lengths of conduit at Lowe's, and they're like $3 a piece. And you can use a conduit bender, and then you stake those with rebar or whatever over your garden and cover them with something called agrabond, which is a woven fabric that allows water and light to come through, but it protects your plants from bugs if you get it on early enough and there's no tears in it. And I always tent my peppers. They love it under there. It's warm and humid, and they grow gloriously and under what I call my pepper tent. So there are other ways to extend your season without actually investing a huge amount of money.
So we can enjoy summer with a farmer's market and lots of bounty. It's time.
Right. It is time. And you know what? If you don't want to go through all that work of planting your garden, go to the farmer's market and support the people that have been doing this for 30 years.
We check in with our Sue Belkum once a week for Main Street Eats. It's always a pleasure, Sue.
Thank you, Doug. Thank you, Ashley.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight. Now you're drifting, growing
distant. You're not alone. Hi, I'm Chris Koza.
And I'm Jordan Myers. We're from Minneapolis.
Join us as we play our Americana pop music here on Prairie Musicians.
Watch Prairie Musicians tonight at 8:30 Central, 7:30 Mountain on Prairie Public.
When you hear arts programming on Prairie Public, know that it's supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Daybook for July 9th. On this date in 1908, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police faced off against a band of armed religious fanatics called Doukhobors. The band was camped at Pearson, Manitoba, 25 miles north of North Dakota. Paradoxically, the Doukhobors were pacifists who refused to serve in the military, but they were heavily armed with rifles. When local police said the Doukhobors had to vacate camp, they formed a defensive circle and threatened to shoot anyone who came near them. And that's when the RCMP was called. The Doukhobors originated in 17th century Russia. They followed the preacher Danilo Filipov, who broke radically from the Orthodox Church. Filipov believed that God dwells in every human being, not in a church. The Doukhobors were pacifists who rejected secular government. The group was persecuted by the Tsars and the church. They settled first in Crimea, then in the Caucasus. In 1899, they were allowed to emigrate, and most went to Canada. A small band found a home in North Dakota. Over the years, some groups of Doukhobors became increasingly radicalized. They lived in their own communities and became insulated from the rest of the world. A small splinter group called Sons of Freedom rejected any government authority. They also rejected personal possessions. They set fire to businesses and even private homes. Because of their disputes with the government over issues like education, they also burned government buildings. They held nude protest parades. Some groups that engaged in farming freed their animals, which they considered their brethren, and pulled their plows and wagons themselves. The group that left North Dakota followed a leader who said he was Jesus Christ. He also said his wife was the Virgin Mary. They traveled to Canada to join another group. The band was no match for the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. The authorities took them into custody and put their children into government schools. Most Doukhobor groups faded out in the 1930s during the Depression. John Verrigan, the great-nephew of a leader known as Peter the Lordly, brought the group back in the 1960s. Today there are about 25,000 descendants of Doukhobors, but less than a third still practice the old ways. Most of them reside in British Columbia. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Carol Butcher. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Listen to NPR News at work, even if you're working in your slippers. Ask your smart speaker to play NPR and stay connected at home.
You've got not one, but two streams of Prairie Public to choose from on your smart speaker. Just ask it and listen.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street, and as I do, I'll remind you that as we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org, and after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show right there at prairiepublic.org. Friday on our show, Matt Olien will join us for a discussion of his favorite movie directors. We'll also hear about a University of Mary choral project that combined the singing of 140 participants recording remotely on video. And News Director Dave Thompson will join us for our Friday discussion of the week's big stories. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.